And I moved to UBC as my first postdoc just several months ago. And this is basically a summary of my previous work with George and also some of the extension work as well. Okay, so. Okay, so so cosmology has been fast developing in the last two decades, and actually we made a lot of progress in understanding how the universe evolves. So it evolved from a very hot and dense status, this work, and to a very cool and clumpy status. So so we see that the genesis event happened like cosmic microwave background formed nearly 14 billion years ago, and we see stars and galaxies that emerged. So I'm going to highlight today some of the themes that seem to be interesting to astronomers and may provide some opportunities and challenges for the coming decades. So we now know that from the very simple six-parameter cosmology that the universe evolved from a continuous timeline, actually, from the very hot and dense status to the very cool and clumpy status. They don't dim this light. Okay. So therefore the three most important epochs, you know, the inflation, the CMB formation of the CMB, and also the formation of first stars, actually divided this continuous timeline equally on the logarithm time scales. So during this process, actually gravity enhanced density contrast and the structures condense out. And to therefore to test this concordance cosmology, we need to set these models in a broad and prospective spectrum of observational tests, and also probe the new and unknown fundamental physics in the very early universe. So we will start these tests from the observations of cosmic microwave background. So to observe the CMB, one of the most important questions people want to ask is whether the universe is statically isotropic. And this question actually linked to the question of does the universe lack of large angle correlations? This is very, it has been debated very, in these several years, actually, by many different groups of whether the universe really lack of large angle correlations, which related to the whether the universe is really statistically isotropic or not. So let's see how people use the lack of large angle correlations to argue that the universe is has some statistically isotropic there. And let's justify whether the argument is right or wrong. Okay, so for those of you who are not working really in the CMB, but here I just basically catch up the basic concept and the formula to describe the CMB statistic. If you have a CMB, two-dimensional CMB large section surface, then all of the temperature fluctuations, delta T as a function of the angle on the two-dimensional sphere, could be decomposed by using spherical harmonics, these YLM functions. And ALM is a coefficient for that decomposition. If the universe statistical isotropy holds, then these ALMs, by doing average, this ALM would be equal to these angular power spectrum CLs. So therefore, the angular correlation function, C of theta function, is defined as the angular average of the 2 points on the CMB large section surface, separated by the angle of theta, and average over the full sky for different value of theta. So therefore, if you substitute these equations here, you get C of theta, C of theta equals to this expression. Substitute here to here, you get this expression. Then if the statistical isotropy hold, then ALMs squared, you get your power spectrum here. Then you substitute this here to here, then you get C of theta is basically a Lorentz transformation of the CLs. And here the summation sigma L from the lowest multiple quadrupole to some cutoff L max. So in reality, if you sum over to L max equals to 15 is enough. So C of theta converge rapidly for the very lowest multiples. So it's most sensitive to the lowest multiples. Okay, So this is a correlation function, so we are going to discuss later. And the often discussed statistic is so-called S1-half statistic, which is defined as the C of theta squared, D cosine theta, integral from minus 1 to 1/2. So S1-half is named by this upper limit, 1/2. So from this integral, you know that theta is actually integrated from 60 degrees to 180 degrees. So which means that just from these expressions, you find that S1-half is basically intended to measure the strength of the correlation function C of theta above 60 degrees. So it's measure the strength on 60 degrees to 180 degrees. So later we'll see whether this is a good statistic or not by doing simulations. Okay, so let's see what's the argument of lack of large angle correlations. So this is in the paper by Kobe et al. And if you have a WMAP, full sky ILC map, 5 years ILC map, then you can measure the angular correlation functions by using the previous equations, just by using doing the average angular average of the product of the temperature fluctuations on the sky. Then you get a black real line here, this black real line here. So, and then they put a mask, which is KQ75 mask. So, because in this map, you see there might be some, there is some residual contaminations on the galactic plane. So to get rid of these residual contaminations, they put a KQ75 mask. The KQ75 basically means that the area, the unmasked area, is take about 75% of the full sky. So this red region here, this part and this part, is about 70% of the full sky. So they put a mask onto this map, therefore they cut off the region along the galactic plane. And there, and then they measure the angular correlation function, C of theta, just from the region of here, northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere. Then they get a black dashed line here, which is here to here, which is a black dashed line here, ILC map here from here. So, and they say that you see C of theta function looks very flat above 60 degrees. So it's basically, it looks pretty flat above 60 degrees. And they quantify the significance of this. So by calculate S1-half numbers for the cut sky, which you put a KQ175 mask on the map, you calculate S1-half numbers, then you get a value of 1,000 also. But to calculate S1-half for the full C of theta function as a black real line we showed before, it's about 800 or so. To quantify the significance of this, these people do a simulation. So they simulate the isotropic CMB map and they calculate the probability to get such a low value. What was
it? Do something with that, otherwise, stay behind me 2 hours.
Okay.
I think you better ask me
remind. Yeah, not that.
Okay, probably I need to put a finger here too. Okay. So so therefore they do simulation. So they simulate the isotropic map for many times and they calculate the probability to get such a low value of S1-half in the isotropic universe. And they get a very small value here, you see. And therefore they argue that thus the full sky results seem to be inconsistent with cut sky results, and they appear inconsistent in the manner that implies most of the large angle correlations in the reconstructed sky map are inside the part of the sky that are contaminated by the galaxy. So therefore they think that if you cut that region out, there is very little correlation there, as they show in the C of theta function. But I think the reason that this very low probability value is because people use a direct pixel estimator, which because they measure the correlation function above the sky, just doing that pixel estimator by averaging the product of the, you know, the temperature fluctuations. This is so-called pixel estimator. The reason they get a low value is because they use pixel estimator of angular correlation function on the cut sky. Later we will see that this is a suboptimal estimator, not the optimal one. Plus they use a posterior choice of the S1-half statistic. So the S1 statistic itself is a posteriori statistic. So why is this? Because if you use a slightly different estimator, so so-called quadratic maximum likelihood estimator here, quadratic maximum likelihood estimator, QML estimator, then you find that no matter whether you put a mask or not, all of the all of these angular correlation functions, C of theta, shows appropriate strength on all different scales. So whether you have a KQ75 mask or KQ85 mask, all of the correlation functions show very consistent result for, with the unmasked map. So the reason of this is because it effectively performs the reconstruction of ALMs but use assumption of statistical isotropic to downweight the ambiguity mode that are poorly constrained by the sky cut. So to illustrate this, how it really works, let me show you this different map reconstruction technique. You have a WMAP 5 years ILC map. As we said, the angular to discuss angular correlation functions, you sum over L mode to L max to about 15 is enough. So we smooth this map to L max about 15. So we only keep the lowest 14 modes because as C of theta function is basically only sensitive to the previous 14 modes. So we smooth it and we put two different masks, KQ75 mask, the red region is about 75% of the full sky, and KQ85 mask is about 80%. So this masking area is smaller than this. So these are just showing experiment for different masks. It's going to the back of the, here. Okay, then you get the cascade map. You cut this region out by by multiplying that mask on the map. Okay, then you do reconstruction. You see that it can pretty well recover the galactic plane region. And then you calculate the C of theta function for the cascade map with that reconstruction technique or the original ILC map. Then you see all of the C of theta functions show appropriate strength on all different scales, and none of them is flat above 60 degrees. So then we show that by using a slightly different estimator, we get very different results. And then we need to compare actually the different estimator. Here, this is the original work. So if you, by Epsilon in 2003, and if you compare he compared the pseudo CL estimator, which is mathematically equals to that direct pixel estimator. So if you compare this estimator with the quadratic maximum likelihood estimator by doing simulations, you see that if you input a quadruple value or an octuple value, input a value, and doing estimation here, doing estimate of it, you find that the pseudo CL, which is effectively the pixel estimator, shows larger variance than the quadratic maximum likelihood estimator. So this line is y equals x, basically. So it's 45 degree line. So you see that here it has larger scatter than the quadratic maximum likelihood estimator. So this estimator, compared with QML, is basically a suboptimal estimator, not the best one. Actually, mathematically, you can also prove that this quadratic maximum likelihood estimator, if you calculate the Fisher matrix, is basically the inverse of the covariance matrix, which means that it's the best estimator you can get.
So let me ask you something here. Mm-hmm. So you're showing here that pseudo CL has a larger scatter in reconstructing the true power spectrum. So then isn't it strange that if you're using the more noisy estimator, you get this power?
What do you mean by?
You're using the more noisy estimator, which is the one on the left, but then you get a smaller S1 half. So usually when you use more noisy things, you have to get more noise, right? So that means you get
as
large as
one. But occasionally for our particularization, something like this. So we get so we have a lower kind of estimate for our particularization of the CMB. We have a lower estimate of that. So so if you compare the quadruple estimate quadruple value for pseudo CL and quadratic maximum likelihood estimator, you find the pseudo CL give you lower value of that. This is our particularization of the universe. Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? So a few slides back, you want to test isotropy, but if I read your slide correctly, you said that the method assumes isotropy to begin with to do the reconstruction. So is there some circularity in the
No, the reconstruction doesn't depend on isotropy. The reconstruction. So what I mean is that
if you go back,
that's a slight difference of this quadratic maximum likelihood estimator and the reconstruction method. So this estimator does assume isotropy, but the reconstruction itself doesn't. So therefore, for this method, you can reconstruct you can estimate CLs very accurate to a pretty high value of L. But for reconstruction, because it doesn't assume isotropy, so your cutoff of L should be very low, so which is about 10 or so, 10 or 15 or so. So there's some slightly different, but this doesn't affect the reconstruction of the map. Yeah.
But does it affect this argument here that's shown in this slide?
So what I show is that the QML estimator can estimate CLs more accurately than the pseudo CLs, and this one actually effectively performs the reconstruction, but adding up the assumption of isotropic. So if we only do the reconstruction part, we can still recover the structure along the galactic plane very well. So
you're comparing here to basically reconstructing map without a mass, and then reconstruction with the mass. And you're showing it matches. I mean, how was the first map? How was the ILC map created? Was it something similar to this? I mean, are you surprised it matched well? Because they must have done some kind of reconstruction to get the background power in the galactic one. So what did they use? And are you really showing that you've recovered the true CLs? Or are you just showing that you managed to map whatever they already did?
So for the ILC map, they basically use, for different maps, they are doing some linear combination by combining different frequency. So therefore, they show some residual contamination on the galactic plane. So here, I mean, our reconstruction can only recover the very lowest multiples. So this one doesn't work for high multiples. So which is different from the, from the technique to.
So is this the real sky or is this just a simulation?
No, this is a real sky.
This is real.
This is real sky. Yeah.
So then.
But
ILC doesn't use a mask. It just combines frequencies.
But just combine frequencies.
Combine frequencies.
Internal linear combination. That's what.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Then let's understand what's the meaning of a posterior statistic. So this plot of S-H Stephen Hawking's initials characterize these problems. Because if you see the CMB map and you see them in this way, then you can see that there might be S and H letters in the WMAP map. So this actually many of the question posed by many of the CMB analysts. They ask, what is oddities can I find in the data given the Lambda-Cydian model? And they find some strange result. But actually, the most sensible question is to ask this question in the Bayesian ways. So given this data, what is the probability of the Lambda-Cydian model? So if you quantify this problem, because this is the only universe we can see, then you probably get a result not that kind of significant. So we can see this by doing this removal of ISW effect. So many of you, you probably know that what's the ISW effect, which is the temperature anisotropy arises by when the photon traveling through a time varying gravitational potential. So therefore delta T, this temperature anisotropy, will equal to the integral of this time varying potential along the line of sight. So you do this integral here. So and the left three plots are the reconstructed density field from the two mass survey. So the left three plots are this phi, the density field phi, observed by two mass, density survey. And people can do this reconstruction by plugging these different potentials into these equations and get the ISW contribution of the temperature anisotropy. So plug into these three the plot here, and one can calculate what is the delta t here. So for each of the corresponding. So these are the contribution from the ISW signal, not really from the primordial CMB. Then you add all of these up because it is an integral. So integrate from T naught to the last second surface. So you adding all of these map together, which is a total contribution from the ISW, and subtract this map from the original ILC map you can get. Then you get this work done by Frankis and Peacock. So then you get C of theta function for the full sky, which is a black real line, and you apply you apply different estimator on it, which is KQ75 and KQ85 mask on it, then you can see that your C of theta show proper strength on all different scales, and none of them is flat on above 60 degrees. And you can calculate your S1 hub numbers for this full sky, which is 1,000 or 10,000 or so, and for different masks, they all show appropriate strength, and none of them is as low as 1,000. It means that.
So this is the maximum likelihood estimator, or is it the pixel estimator? Which estimator
is it? Which one?
The numbers you're quoting here is this one.
These I have just calculated from the C of theta integral. So you get your C of theta here, you calculate that integral.
So that's the pseudo CLs are probably so. Or is it maximum likelihood
estimator? Maximum likelihood
estimator. It's maximum likelihood.
Yeah.
But the problem was with this other one, the pixel estimator. Maximum likelihood didn't give you a small number, this, right?
Which one?
So there are two ways to
calculate. Yeah, so this C of theta is pixel estimator.
That's pixel estimator.
Okay. So you see that they are still they are not very low. Okay. Then so therefore this is the meaning of a posteriori. So you know that if they get a map with the ISW signal removed already, then they plot the C of theta function and they can see that it shows appropriate strength on all different scales. Then they wouldn't invent such a statistic as one half to characterize the strength of correlation function above 60 degrees. Then they wouldn't claim such a discrepancy. So therefore, it means that you know some result and you invent an estimator to characterize the significance of this particular realization. And eventually you exaggerate the statistical significance of it. So unless you really want to argue that there is a physical alignment of the local structure with a potential fluctuation at the last-second surface that conspire to remove large-scale correlation outside the galactic mask, this kind of theory is not very plausible, but maybe it could be possible. But in general, it's not plausible. So otherwise, you have to admit that you use a posterior statistic of your S1 half. Okay, so this is the first part. So I basically described to you that by using an optimal estimator of the CMB correlation function and also using appropriate estimator, you don't get a very strong discrepancy here. So the discrepancy is due to the suboptimal estimator and the a posterior statistic. Okay, so this is the WMAP 7 years paper by Charles Burnett in 2010, and you see that here there is no large angle cosmology significance for the orientation of the sky cut, and therefore the result from the Sproul et al. This is a WMAP first year paper and must be a coincidence. So they admit these things. Okay, so let's.
So actually, just one point. So I mean, this is just saying that it cannot be a cosmological effect, but it could be some instrumental artifact. Right. I mean, this analysis doesn't rule out the fact that this could be an instrumental artifact because, So if WMAP is screwing something up, then it has nothing to do with ISW.
Could you talk about this as one statistic for COVID?
No. COVID has similar lack of power, but has much bigger error. So I just have to make two comments, and I think people go back and forth on this one. I don't think we're going to settle this here. But one is that I don't think this is a posteriori statistic because it was defined not for COVID quite, but for WMAP 1. And then it was measured for all the subsequent WMAP releases. And the probability went down. So it went from a few percent to 0.04%. So it's not a posteriori in the sense that it was defined for WMAP 1, but it was measured for WMAP 7.
But it was actually proposed at WMAP 1. So
that's right.
And at the time, people used this estimator to quantify the significance.
But that it was a posteriori for WMAP 1, but for WMAP 7, it wasn't a posteriori.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And the probability became lower if you use the naive estimator. So I agree with you that maximum likelihood is okay. But if you use this other one, it's not okay. The original.
But just to argue with you, I mean, isn't it true that even by WMAP 1, measurement wasn't really noise dominated because it's the low L's, so it must be cosmic variance limited, so it's not surprising that the number didn't change much.
No, it did change.
Well, it went a little bit lower, but...
two orders of magnitude lower. It went from like percent to 0.03% or something. And the reason is that there was a calibration change from WMAP 1 to WMAP 3. So they changed the larger scale power. It's surprisingly just lowered S1 now. But I don't think that table had it, but the S1 half is much less likely now than it was for that one.
I'm not very clear for those calibration kind of things, so.
Anyways,
maybe we can discuss it offline.
Sure.
Okay. Right. So let's go back to this continuous timeline again. So the CMB actually not only characterizes the density, the density fluctuation in the very early universe, but it also carries momentum information on the tensor mode as well. For theories, it could be more interesting because it related to the primordial gravitational wave, which may open another new window for testing models of the early universe. So as we know that the perturbation in the very early universe here, on a very large scale, they stretch out of the Hubble radius and get frozen and enter into the horizon again. So therefore, we can, by observing on a very large scale CMB, we can see the perturbation in at very early times. So primordial gravitational wave, different from density perturbations, once it's entered into the Hubble radius, it will decay rapidly. So we can only see it on the very large scales. Therefore, we need models of the universe. As you are all serious, you probably know this pretty well, much better than me. So for this single field slow inflation model, very simple, the inflaton rolling down from the potential. And therefore, it generalizes the primordial perturbations. The amplitude of this tensor mode, Pt over Ps, the amplitude, the ratio between the tensor power spectrum and the scalar power spectrum, is related to the particular shape of this inflation potential. And the detail value of these R actually related to the field, the range of the field evolve during inflation, whether it's greater than Planck mass or not, depends on the detail value of this R. And also this R value is also linked to the energy scale of inflation. So this is so-called the Lise bound. So therefore the meaning of therefore it's very important to measure the value of this R. That's many of the current CMB experiments are going after for. So they're all going after the value of this R. So at the same time, this is we have many other speculative possible speculative models, and one of the brain world model means that our universe is embedded in the high dimensional kind of origami, and different slices may move together from by some potential attractions, and therefore they will bound into each other and collapse and thermalize a hot Big Bang. And the leftover for this scenario is the cosmic spring, which kind of sources also the CLBB, which is a B-mode power spectrum of the CMB. And the relationship between the power spectrum and the strength of this G mu is the strength of this cosmic string. There is a power of two basic relation between these two. So one can put together the standard single field slow inflation predictions and also the speculative model of the from the brain inflation and we can compare these things and compare also with the current available data of the B-mode polarization. And here I plot the single fuel slow inflation at the blue line here with R equals to 0.03. And this is possible, 0.03 is possible to be seen by by Planck at a 2 sigma basic confidence level. So they have already done some calibration and also some simulation for it. So this 0.03 is possibly be seen by that confidence level. And also I plot here the cosmic spring predictions with G mu equals to 10 to the minus 7 as this pink line here. So this pink line you see it peaks at higher multiples. So therefore it suffered a lot from this lensing confusion. So because gravitational lensing can convert some of the E mode into B mode and make you actually act as a effective noise. So these data are for the very large scale black data is a W-5 years data of the COBB. And the middle regime is ground-based bicep data. And for small scales is ground-based quad data. So we see that WMAP data probably at a very large scale, but its error bar is too big. So we will use bicep and quad data to quantify the value of R and also the G mu. So here I don't have.
What was the red curve?
Pardon?
What was the red curve?
Red curve. So the red curve is another speculative model from the loop quantum gravity.
Okay.
So this mass parameter and K star parameter is basically a phenomenological model parameter for loop quantum gravity. So we can discuss it later. Basically, so one parameter defines the amplitude of this curve. The another parameter K star defines the position of this. So if you varying K star, it will basically move this curve to be left-hand side or right-hand side. Therefore, it may move the peak of this different curve on larger and smaller scales. So it basically characterizes when the perturbation enters into the horizon.
So do you know what the physics of this loop quantum gravity
was? So they basically say that before Big Bang, there was a big crunch as well. So there was something happened before Big Bang. So some of the mode at very large scales may stretch out of the horizon before Big Bang and stretch into the horizon again. But some of the mode, so the small scale mode will be just as the standard evolution. So it's always under the horizon. And so you can get some modulation on very large scales, not very small scales. And these, therefore, in their power spectrum, they can show a bump into their power spectrum. And these K star parameter actually control the position of that bump. So yeah, and this mass parameter controls the amplitude of that. Yeah, okay. So we don't have time to see all of the details, but here I gave a summary of the constraint. We have a single field slow inflation, and by applying just to the ground-based experiment, bicep and quad, we can get some pretty tight, not very tight, but pretty tight constraint of R. And W-7 years plus BAO plus H naught can give you such upper limits. So it's basically reaching the similar level, but still looser than the other complementary constraint. And for cosmic string is by using these two data sets, you get G mu less than 8 times 10 to the minus 7. And by applying all of these, a lot of different data sets, but not really the tensor mode, not really the B mode polarization. So use the temperature fluctuations. So by applying these different things and applying also adding some BBN prior and in it, and this group get G mu less than 2 times 10 to the minus 7. So you see that B mode polarization basically, although the data isn't very good now, but it's already reaching the similar level of the other complementary data set. So
to get the constraint from bicycle quad, what are you assuming about the lens?
Pardon? Oh, so we assume a standard lensing power spectrum and assume a kind of a fraction of delensing factor. Basically, we add the gravitational lensing as an effective noise. Yeah.
So
we add gravitational lensing as an effective noise, basically.
Effective noise. So are you calibrating on any sort of expectation based on other measurements implementing the CMB to predict what the BE lensing power spectrum should be? or are you just treating it as a total nuisance parameter?
Yeah, I treat it as a known, basically, and as a known noise, basically. Yeah.
You can calculate the spectrum from lambda CDM, right?
Yeah, you can. Yeah, that's what I did. So for the forecast for the future experiment, let's see what we can get for the future experiment. And here, these are different observations. Planck is going to release the data maybe next year or the year after. And CMB Pole and some other experiments, Spider, which is a Bloomberg experiment, some ground-based experiment as well, polar bear and quiet. We get this different R over delta R, signal-to-noise ratio here. So you see that Planck, as we say, 0.03, they can detect 0.03 at about 2 sigma level. So 0.01 is here, 0.23 here. So they can detect it at 2 or 3 sigma level. And I think, so this ground-based experiment, although they measure only a fraction of the sky, but because they have better beam and also lower noise, so therefore they can improve the Planck detection at some levels. But I think the important thing is that we remember the detection limit. For instance, this CMB pole, which as shown in this purple line, your value of R has to be greater than 10 to the minus 3. Otherwise, it still be basically non-detectable. And here, so the R has to be greater than 10 to the minus 3. And then to make it detectable. So this is the delta NT, which is the tilt of the tensor power spectrum. So this is even harder to be detected because this delta NT, if delta NT minus to equals minus R over 8 is the standard consistent relation in the single field slower inflation. So here I show you this delta T equals R minus 8 as this red curve here. So only if your experiment is kind of, you can measure delta T less than this curve, less than this line, you can see the tilt of the tensor power spectrum. So we see that only the CMB pole here, the purple line here, has some intersect with this red dashed line. Only the CMB pole with R equals 0.2 also you can measure this tilt of the tensor power spectrum, which means that the tilt is too hard to be seen. And for the cosmic string here, different experiments also have different signal to noise ratios, and the detection limit is about g mu equals to 10 to the minus 8. So if your value is lower than that, then it's not realistic to see it.
What about the polarized foregrounds?
What would you mean by polarized foreground?
Well, magnetic fields in the galaxy and things causing spurious beam modes.
Oh, I haven't quantified that.
I mean, how does it order of magnitude? How does it compare with these numbers?
Okay.
My guess is it's large. I don't know.
Okay. Okay, maybe we can see it. Yeah, we can. Yes.
So you haven't included foregrounds, the polarization foreground errors.
I included.
You haven't.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get back to this timeline again. So we can not only see the CMB large length surface, CMB fluctuation at the large length surface, but also because the density enhanced the gravity enhanced density contrast, and therefore the structure condenses out. And therefore, we should not only see test these models in a very early time, but also see whether this model can match the current large structure observations. And actually, we can see a huge number of galaxies, and this is a plane of 600 million light years, basically 100 microparsecs or so, the number of galaxies. We can see a lot of them, and we can actually. Nowadays, we can not only see the galaxy, but also measure its velocities in a shallow, basically, catalog, shallow survey. And this is the spiral F-field I-band catalog, the current biggest peculiar velocity field catalog we can obtain at the moment. And these are the galaxies over the full sky. The red point is the galaxy moving away from us, and the blue point is the galaxy moving towards us. So we can see them basically we can not only measure their positions, but also their velocity as well. And how this linked to our test of cosmology, how we can use this data to test cosmology. So to do this, we need to recall the linear perturbation theory. The velocity is linked to the time evolution of the density contrast through this equation. So this is delta E dot means that the time evolution of your density contrast linked to the velocity in the Fourier space through these equations in the quasi-static limit. And therefore, you can change this equation V to be like this. And therefore, this V is linked to the growth factor as D here. So we can define a special function, this growth function F, which is linked to the time derivative of this growth factor D. And from this F function, we know that V is linked to this F and also equals to the product of A and also the Hubble parameter H and also the density contrast delta over K. So we see that actually the peculiar velocity actually carries more power on larger scales because the 1 over K factor. If you have on the larger scales, you have a smaller value of K, and therefore compared with density contrast, this way carries more power on large scales. And also from these different from this H and also this F here, we see that is basically linked to cosmological parameters. So you can use these data to do cosmology here. And making a square of it, the power spectrum of peculiar velocity equals to the matter power spectrum, link them into this way. And because you make a square here, you get even more larger power on the K. It's 1 over K square factor here. And these P of K matter power spectrum, as probably you know, could be parameterized by using matter density, etc. You know, omega lambda, omega matter, you know, Hubble constant, etc., etc. So here is a typical called EBW fitting formula by linking this P of K to these cosmological parameters. But to really do cosmology, there's overall uncertainty here. So there's a prefactor here. It isn't really pretty well known. It's basically a free parameter, basically, to describe the amplitude of these fluctuations. Okay, so to extract the information of the shape of this power spectrum, which may sensitive to the history of the structure growth, we can alternatively define a estimator, so-called cosmic Mach number, which is a ratio between the mean square velocity over the velocity dispersion. The reason of this is because both the denominator and the numerator are all linked to the overall unknown normalization factor. And therefore, you make a ratio of these two and you cancel out the prefactor here. And this is a calculation, how to calculate this from the lambda CDM. By integral over P of P theta theta over some window functions. Let's
explain what these are. What is the physical meaning of V squared and sigma squared?
So I explain it here.
Right.
Okay. So it means that if you have many galaxies close to each other, for instance, and this galaxy may, if you decompose their velocity, so each of the galaxies have some velocities. Maybe you don't know, maybe you just have a basic catalog of these velocities of each different galaxies. And maybe you can figure out they have some co-moving motion along some directions. So therefore, you can decompose the velocities into a bulk motion, which is a streaming motion of all of these galaxies towards some particular directions. And some random motion of these each individual galaxies. And these two velocities actually carries different information because the streaming motion of all of the galaxies towards some particular directions carries information on very large scales. It means that, for instance, these galaxies, if they're all moving towards these directions, it may mean that here there are some great attractor here to pull these galaxies towards these directions. On the other side, the residual so-called velocity dispersion carries information of the local density field, right? Because each of the galaxies, they basically locate in their particular environment. So they may have some these carries local density field information. So one is on large scale, one is on small scale, but both of these are linked to the total amplitude of your fluctuations. And therefore, to make a ratio of this U and sigma star, you get an idea of the structure formation, because you cancel out this total unknown amplitude. And the ratio of these two is linked to the ratio of your perturbation from the large scales over the small scales. So that's the meaning of the previous defined estimator. So you can calculate from the velocity catalog, and here is some likelihood of it. I just jump out these things. We have a limit, time limit, but I show you the result of the estimate from the catalogs. So here, I plot the Mach number m as a function of r. R means different scales. Where the R runs from 10 megaparsec, 15 megaparsec to 100 megaparsec or so. So you see that the lambda CDM gives you M of R as a decreasing function here, the red line here, the black line here. And the current data, as we've shown in this blue dot here, blue triangle dot here. And they match pretty well. And the early data in 1990s basically provides shallower, shallower data. So one is here, one here, one is here. So in the very early days, people claim there is an inconsistency between the theory and the observations. They basically claim the inconsistency of the data with the CDM models in the early time. And that's because in the early time in 1990s, the cosmology that was pretty old at the time. So omega m is believed to be equal to unity, and the special index equals to the unity as well. So if you plot the prediction of the Mach number in the 1990s, you see the green dashed line here. So they look inconsistent with the red point in the 1990s. But cosmology does change to make this red line to be a black line here. So it does change. And also, in addition, we plot the neutrino, the model with neutrino, non-zero neutrino mass, and also some non-zero, basically this is a scale-dependent growth factor for the FFR model. They also a little bit different with the lambda CDM, but the difference is smaller than the capability of the current data to distinguish them. So the reason that for massive neutrino and FFR model, which is a modified gravity model with slightly non-zero scale-dependent growth factor, is because the alternative theories, such as this FFR model, actually have scale-dependent, also time-dependent gravitational constant. It's basically changed the gravity on different scales. And this B-naught factor, which I've shown equals to 10 to the minus 4, is linked to this scale-dependent gravitational constant. Here, G effective equals to the mu, which is modulation dimensionless function, times this G. So this mu function could be parameterized as in this form. So lambda 1 is basically linked to the time, linked to this K square. So a non-zero B-naught means that this mu is a function of K. So yeah, so if you go to nonlinear, Mach number does suppress a little bit. But if you look at the data above 15 megaparsec, the nonlinear effect is small.
I mean, small scale.
Small scale, there are nonlinear effects.
So
yeah.
you had up to 10 megaparsec, I think.
Yeah, but when you really use Mach number to quantify, you use the data above 15 megaparsec. Yeah.
You can use this. Galaxies in clusters, or even for inside the galaxy, for instance, using ruler clusters inside the galaxy. Yeah, I mean, if you go very non-linear structures, so how this Mach number?
The Mach number will suppress.
Suppress.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and also massive neutrino can also produce scale dependent growth because neutrino has a free streaming effect. So you can basically dump out the structure on some scales. And here I show you this is a fractional difference between the velocity divergence power spectrum with the lambda CVM, and also the fractional difference of the growth function f here. So FFR model, molecular gravity model with slightly different scale dependent growth factor, then give you a basic enhancement of the structure above some degrees, above some scales. And these massive neutrino can also damp out some of the structures below 0.2 h over megaparsec. So this line, this black line is lambda CM. To make a forecast, we see that maybe 60F with 10 billion galaxy velocity catalog may be able to distinguish this difference with the lambda CEM. And here we separate the data into the forecast data into different bins and figure out the error bars. And you see that it may have the, it may be capable of distinguishing the difference between FFR model and lambda CEM, and also difference between massive neutrino and the non-neutrino model in different error bar, in different scale of R here. So this technique could be a sensitive test of the structural growth if you have precise and large number of catalog of galaxy peculiar velocities. Okay, so at the same time, I want to address another puzzle. This is the work I've been doing with Hume Feldman in Kansas, and also Christopher Gordon used to be in Oxford, to explain the possible, to provide a possible explanation for the very large.
My husband,
yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Of course. Sorry. Yeah, so to explain the very large bulk flow. As we see, this is the conventional understanding of the galaxy peculiar velocity. Some of the galaxy velocity could be decomposed into a bulk motion, which is streaming motion, and also the velocity dispersion, which characterizes the local density environment. And the very large bulk flow, which is the people, by using this power spectrum, people figure out the basically the total amplitude of the amplitude of perturbations. And you see that by using the velocity catalog, they can make a likelihood for this sigma 8, which is the total amplitude of large scale structures. And you see that they find a pretty large value of sigma 8, which is seem to be large compared with the lambda CDM. And the bulk flow value, which is about 400 kilometers per second, seem to be quite large compared with the lambda CDM. And I think in the conventional understanding of the very large bulk flow, this is the conventional understanding, the CMB defined rest frame is equal to the matter rest frame, which means that the CMB itself, for instance, the CMB itself is isotropic. Then the nearby object of not only the observer, but also the shallow catalog, which is less than 100 megaparsec scales, those nearby objects are all moving towards some particular directions because we are all in some kind of potential well, and therefore we all fall into the potential well. Therefore, we move towards some particular directions. And in general, but if our survey can probe very, 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 very far galaxies, then we find the very distant galaxies should be all in their own random motion. There shouldn't be any systematic movement towards some particular directions. And this effect is pretty local. Therefore, the matter rest frame is equal to CMB defined rest frame. So if we average this V vector, the bulk flow vector, over some particular scale, and if this scale going to infinity, this V squared is going to be zero. So if you average larger and larger volumes, this velocity will die out because very distant galaxy should be rest with a matter rest frame. Actually, this scenario depends on the assumption because the assumption of the CMB dipole is solely due to our local motion with respect to the CMB rest frame. So this is a galaxy redshift C times Z, the redshift equals to the co-moving as Kolmogorov expanding, basically, of the universe, plus the peak velocity effect. So the redshift is due to not only the Kolmogorov motion with the universe expanding, but also because their peculiar velocity on the cosmic grid, which is this part. And here, when we discuss velocity, we always mention that the velocity towards what, right? We need to set up a frame. And your measured velocity is because your survey is on the Earth, so your telescope is on the Earth, so your measured velocity is towards our own local system. But when we discuss velocity, I mean, people has already corrected it in the CMB-defined red frame. So here, they treat this V naught as a CMB dipole, which is our local motion with respect to the CMB red frame. So if you characterize a velocity in the CMB red frame, you need to subtract this CMB dipole here. And our conventional understanding of the CMB dipole is that this dipole effect is solely due to our local motion with respect to the Larsing surface. But however, there might be possible that there could be a large scale inhomogeneity across the sky. Maybe there is some intrinsic dipole on the CMB sky. So in this sense, the CMB dipole is due to the intrinsic fluctuations plus the kinetic dipole. It means that it's just like a two vector. So eventually the CMB dipole is the total effect of the of these two vector here. So if the part of the CMB dipole is due to the intrinsic fluctuations, then when you subtract out our local motion, you think you only subtract out our local motion, but then you actually also subtract out the intrinsic dipole as well. So in this case, after you subtract the intrinsic dipole, your CMB defined red frame isn't equal to the matter red frame. So these plots, these basically cartoon figures show you how this really works. So because you subtract not only our local motion, but also the intrinsic fluctuations. So for the galaxy, which is really, really distant apart, they should not move in the matter red frame, but because you subtract out the intrinsic dipole. So they seem to be moving, but this is they seem to be moving in the CMB defined red frame. So in this sense, the CMB defined red frame isn't equal to the matter red frame. These galaxies are all moving in the CMB defined red frame. So at this time, if you average these velocities, you get non-zero. Even if you average larger and larger radius. So here, this is not conventional understanding of the bulk flow. This is so-called the tilted universe. We can compensate this intrinsic dipole as a tilted velocities, and what we measure is the line of sight velocity in the CMB defined red frame. We can compensate as this velocity as another u vector here, and therefore we subtract this u vector. We get the observed line of sight velocity in the CMB defined red frame, and we can calculate a covariant matrix for this u vector as this function here, and therefore we can we know the likelihood basically for this tilted velocity u and also the sigma star value, which is a small scale velocity dispersion, because this sigma star doesn't really characterized by this tilted velocity. It's another information. And this is the likelihood for the value of the sigma star and also the tilted velocity here. And you see that by applying different catalogs, the value of this u are pretty consistent with 400 kilometers per second, these values. And the contours between the magnitude of these tilted velocities and also the small scale velocity dispersions shows very orthogonal to each other. And the reason is because this u, which is a tilted velocities, which means it means that the very large scale modulation across the CMB. So it means that some part of the CMB is intrinsically hotter than the others. But these sigma star parameters characterize the galaxy local density field. So one is in, so the U is the information on the Larsing surface, and the sigma star is the information on the local density field. So these two things are never, shouldn't be degenerate with each other. They're completely different things. So you see that the contours are all very orthogonal to each other. In terms of the angle of this tilted velocity, where it is, here is a posterior distribution of the cosine theta. So theta is 2 pi minus b, so 2 pi minus galactic latitude. And this phi value is basically the galactic longitude in radians. So you can see different catalogs, they are all consistent with each other, and this is recent work by Edward McCauley. You see that they put our paper and also Mike's paper and also the other groups. Here you see that by applying different catalog, they all basically consistent with each other. The direction of this velocity basically consistent. And let's get some physical understanding of this. What is this? How much time I have? About okay. Yeah, this finish up. Last part. Okay, let's get some understanding of this. Where this velocity come from? As we know that the adiabatic initial condition actually will not result in such a large scale dipole modulations. Only isocurvature mode is possible. This is because only isocurvature mode can produce you basically a modulation of different ratio of the species on the three-dimensional hypersurface, different from place to place, and therefore it can make the the photons and the photons and baryons basically moving in the different in different speed. So therefore this QD velocity U over C by Michael Turner's paper, this U over C is proportional to the product of the geometric factor and the quantum fluctuation factor. So let's get some understanding. So this if we think the quantum fluctuations in the early universe, delta phi over phi naught, is about order one, then this U over C would be approximately equal to the geometric factor, H naught inverse over L. And let's understand what's the meaning of this geometric factor. So if you have a part of sky whose length scale is equal to the Hubble radius at the initial point of inflation, then this part of the sky will be inflated to a part of the sky which scale is equal to this L. This L equals to e to the delta n times H naught inverse, where this H naught is the current Hubble radius. And this delta n is equal to the n minus n minimum. N is the real number of e-fold of inflation minus the minimal number of e-fold of inflation required to solve the horizon problems. So we know that inflation has to last about like 60 number of e-fold to explain the horizon problem, et cetera, et cetera. But the inflation could happen much longer than that. So this n is a real number of e-fold of inflation, and this n minimum is a minimal number of inflation to require to solve the problem, solve the puzzles. So it means that if a part of sky whose length scale is about the Hubble radius, at the onset of inflation, at the initial point of inflation, then this part of sky will be inflated to this part of sky. Length scale is this big. If inflation happens just about 60 number of e-fold, then this delta n equals to zero. E to the delta n equals one. Then this part of sky will be just inflated to the part of sky which is Hubble radius, and just be able to solve the horizon problem, these puzzles. But if inflation happens much longer than that, then this residual number of e-fold will blow up the scale of this part of the sky. So if you have, say, a very long inflation, then this exponential factor will blow up this L, which means that this part of the sky, which scale equals to the Hubble radius, will be inflated to the very, very large scale. And this U over C will equal to H inverse over L, and therefore by plugging this equation here, you see that U over C approximately equal to the e to the minus delta n. It means that if the inflation happened not very longer than the minimum number of e-folds, 60 number of e-folds, then there might be still some residual large-scale superhorizon modulation on the sky, which is not exponentially very far away. But if inflation happened very, very long, then if e to the minus delta n would be nearly zero, then you wouldn't see any, every perturbation will be washed out, you wouldn't see any large-scale modulations. So this is the meaning of the 2D universe. So by applying these different catalogs, we know basically the we know the value of this magnitude of this U. And by plugging this into the previous equation, of course, there are some speculative assumptions during this process. But we can basically get a speculative delta N here, which is the excess number of e-fold of inflation required to provide a such a dipole modulations. So, so this data, I mean, imply that inflation lasts not very longer than 60 number of e-fold. And let me resume the idea of here. So the whole story of this explanation of the very large bulk flow is that if inflation doesn't happen much longer than 60 number of e-fold, then the excavation mode may produce your dipole modulation on the CMB sky. And therefore, there could be some intrinsic fluctuations on the CMB sky. Then when you correct for the CMB dipole, you think that the CMB dipole is solely due to our local motion. But actually, you also correct, you subtract out some of the intrinsic fluctuations. And therefore, the galaxies seem to be moving towards some particular directions. And these moving velocities seem to be too large compared with the lambda CDM predictions because of the because you correct you actually subtract out some of the intrinsic fluctuations. So this is the whole logic or the chain of this whole logic. Okay. So let me summarize since the time is going to finish. So the apparent lack of large angle correlations is due to the Kaskai pixel estimator plus they use a Poisson statistic. I mean, I say a Poisson means WMI first year, not yeah. Okay. So, and our CMB experiment not only provide you a test of this isotropic test, but also the polarization information can also be able to use to test a model of the early universe. And by observing the Laskar structures, we know that peculiarity of galaxy can provide you much information on structural growth, and therefore a powerful tool to distinguish molecular gravities or non-zero neutrino mass. And the tilted universe, as we explained, is potentially an interesting scheme to explain the anomalies of the very large bulk flow. And of course, to test this or test whether the data is consistent with your lambda CDM, we need deeper and full sky observations of the velocity catalog. And so many of the themes that we are discussing today and may provide astronomers with opportunities and challenges in the coming decade. Thank you very much. Okay, good point.
I think supernova also of data provides the direction, the appropriate direction for particular velocity in the local universe.
Yeah.
So are there any?
Yeah. There are some difference. So not only the magnitude, but also the large scale structure, but also the direction. So CMB dipole is measured to be about 620 or so kilometers per second. And this large scale structure dipole is about 400 also, as we see. And not only the magnitude, but also the angle. I remember this like 20 degree or so in terms of.
From which to which?
The CMB dipole direction and the large scale structure dipole direction.
Probably
30. 30, okay.
But of course, you've got to correct for the kind of the basic motion that we know about. Motion around the Milky Way. I mean, the CMB dipole isn't just the motion of the Milky Way, it's also our motion within the Milky Way.
Yeah.
So you subtract that off, of course, right? And then you try to
compare the
large scale structure.
Yeah.
I think the best way to look at it is that 600 kilometers per second, you can think about them as being different spheres, right? The 600 kilometers per second is what happens when you get outside the local group and you remove most of the nonlinearities, right? And then as you go to larger and larger spheres, of course, it's the draw. The question is how quickly is it draw?
Yeah.
So CMB, the 600 kilometers that you're talking about is really has a contribution, for example, from Virgo, which is very near to us. So when you get to larger scales, you don't see that.
But
that's why the angle changes.
I've heard the 600 kilometers per second before, and it's just never clear. Was that already
corrected? That's after corrected for the motion of ourselves around the galaxy, the infall between galaxy and M31 typically.
Okay, so that's the Andromeda Milky Way system, the 600 kilometers per second.
But then if you compare that local group to a slightly larger radius, like a 5 megaparsec, so this is Tully's local sheet, the motion of that group with respect to that sheet is very small, so that 600 also represents the motion of, say, a 5 megaparsec radius here, which is about where you can start to apply linear theory.
Yes. General comment. Whenever there's an anomaly in the atmosphere, there always seems to be a way to get around it. So the theory gets more and more complicated.
The theory gets more and more complicated.
The anomaly occurs in the standard model. There seems to be a way to remove it. Some explanation.
Okay.
So, the theory gets more complicated if more anomalies occur. Because we have to keep producing these explanations. So, the question is to what extent do we
the model keeps getting somewhat more elaborate and more complex.
It's the same model. It's the interpretation of the statistic that changes, right? Whether or not it's really saying something about the model or whether it's just saying something.
How do they make a decision about
the
statistics?
So, John, until you come up with a simpler model, that's the status.
Well, as Adrian said, the only time you change the model was in that last part with the tilt, which I think
tilt is a change.
Most people wouldn't argue that that is standard CVM. That's something else.
Yeah.
Right?
We don't know yet.
Yeah. That's the only part I changed the model, not the previous part. The previous part I just checked with the statistics. Yeah.
So Kishlinski is right, and I don't think he is. What does that mean for the tilted universe? You know? We're moving at 1,000 kilometers per second. You know, the Kishlinski result. Does that change anything?
Change these things?
Yeah, I mean, you showed some data sets including some of ours, but you didn't talk about this most controversial one.
Yeah.
Which is this Kishlinski kinetic Semyon-Zeldovich
effect. Yeah, I just think this is too much controversial, and I think if we really move in such high speed, then we should be able to see it by using the current catalogs, right? By using your catalog and also some other catalogs, we should already see it.
Yeah, I mean, you could have a contrived scenario where. The very much larger volume that Kishlinski measures is moving at 1,000, and somehow there's local sources that are pushing us back the other way so that we measure a bulk flow which is not as big as theirs.
Okay.
In principle, possible. I don't think it's very likely, but.
Yeah. So, to really check whether Kishlinski, say, is right or not, I mean, for instance, to test whether such kind of contrived model is possible or not. We need to understand all of these very local velocities, right?
I mean, but you could say from Kishlinski's point of view, you can disregard the local stuff, and if he was really right, and that huge volume is moving at 600 to 1,000 kilometers per second, there's no way whatsoever you could get that in lambda CDM, right? You have to have some funny mechanism.
Yeah.
And I think that's the wrong approach. You cannot do that data based on theory.
I'm not saying you should.
But that's what you're saying, isn't it?
No. 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 I'm saying if Kishlinski is right, then you need a tilt.
Yeah.
It would be
I just happen not to believe that Pichlinsky's right, but not because
I don't
disbelieve him because I believe Lambda CDM. I disbelieve Pichlinsky because I can't reproduce. PM can't reproduce his results. So that's different.
So there is a logical expression for this Schamford. It's called vacuous truth. So you're making an assumption which is wrong, yes, to say if Kaczynski is right.
Right.
And anything that follows that doesn't
yes.
Yeah.
I don't believe him because I don't trust his data analysis, not because
he
disagrees with Lambda CDM.
I understand. Thank you.
Right.
That's a fair point. But I guess nobody lives this in this room.
There was a paper, I think, at the end of 2010, so it's about November of 2010, basically doing same analysis of Kaczynski's, and they used slightly different estimator, but they didn't find such high speed. So, by, I think, Sarah Church in Stanford and her student. Yeah,
they've done it, and Enzo Brandt talked about it. Remember Enzo Brandt?
Enzo, yeah.
And before Ian was here, Nayesh and I had a student who also tried to reproduce it. So it seemed hard to reproduce.
How would I help
you? I will listen to you too.
Thank you.